Well, welcome everybody, and welcome to another episode of Passports, Please, conversations about the power of place, the places that change us, and why it matters. I'm your co-host, Dr. Chick Morgan, the Cowgirl PhD Diva, and I am with...
Rodney Burseal.
The photographer-in-chief and co-host. So we have been having just such a great and interesting time with our conversations with some fabulous people, and today we have yet another one. As you know, we've transitioned from our series on Africa, and we are now talking to folks who can entertain us and, most importantly, educate us about big things in the water, as I like to call them. Rodney knows that this is a particularly good episode for our season for me to engage. It's not one I'm familiar with, right, Rodney?
I think you and I are both going to learn some stuff on this.
I think we are. So our guest today is Mike Coots. And I'm sure there are many of you that are listening that heard that he was going to be on our podcast. I think our numbers jumped enormously, didn't they, Rodney?
they keep growing, so yeah.
So all kidding aside, Mike is exceptionally well-known in the aquatic world and the surfing world, the photography world, and certainly in the world of shark advocacy and conservation. And so we're just going to jump right in. I had your official titles listed as surfer and professional ocean photographer and prominent shark conservation advocate. But you know, Rodney, a lot of people can kind of fall into those categories. So let's talk about what makes Mike so special, and maybe he can jump in here. Welcome, Mike.
Hi, guys. Oh, thank you for that beautiful intro. Aloha.
Aloha.
Dr. Morgan and Rodney. Yeah.
So good to hear your voice. I don't think you and I have talked for a couple years.
Since that magical day we had, or magical week we had in the Bahamas.
Yeah, and I guess that's kind of where we can start with this, too.
Before we do that, Mike, could you enlighten us as to where you're calling in from?
Yeah, I'm on the island of Kauai, in the state of Hawaii. It's a beautiful morning here. We've had a couple weeks of pretty typical trade wind weather, and yeah, it's a beautiful day outside and a cool maybe 85 degrees.
And you're born and raised there, right?
I am. Yeah. I was born in a little hospital called Wilcox, and spent all the way up until I was about 14 on Kauai, and didn't really travel too much. Then we took a family holiday to New Zealand, and my parents fell in love with it. And they applied for citizenship, and we got it, packed up and left. And I spent a couple years in New Zealand, and then finished high school here in Hawaii. And I, right out of high school, I had an unfortunate incident with a tiger shark.
We're going to hear a little bit more about it.
Yeah. And we can get into that, but and it's kind of as like defining as that would be, I would say, Rodney, that trip that we took together was even more so, at Tiger Beach. That week we spent was, I will never forget those few days on the ocean and just,
That was your,
first time. Yeah.
And was that your first time scuba diving or first time in the water with sharks after your accident?
It was my first time in the water with tiger sharks. I had done some cage diving in Mexico with great whites, but it was my first time pretty much out of the water with a tiger shark. I still remember it so vividly, and it really was a defining week in my life.
You've mentioned a couple of times, and Rodney has too, about that incident with the tiger shark. Would you mind walking us through that and telling us that story? Because it's amazing.
This was in late October 1997. I was 18 years old at the time, and I was a real avid bodyboarder. Boogie boarding was really big here in Hawaii, and most of my friends were making a decent living doing it, and that's the career I really wanted to take. And I had a coach, and we had a really bad summer. I remember the waves like day in and day out for weeks, if not it was months, like dead flat. And came early surf season was in October, and I later found out we call it Sharktober, and there kind of seems to be an uptick in shark attacks. And it was right before Halloween, and we saw the swell forecast about a week out and got so excited. And that morning we pulled up to the beach, and I was with my surfing coach along with probably five other teammates. It's on a military base, and it's a long sandy beach, and you can literally drive your vehicle right up to the sand, which we did. And I remember we had this old scout vehicle, like an old 4x4 scout. Mm-hmm. And I remember we're all just crammed in there, and we've got our lunch for the day, and the sun was rising, and this was maybe a little past 7 in the morning, and we opened the car doors, and instantly I smelt a really foul, fishy, stinky smell. Like I've never smelt that since then. And I'd never smelt it prior. Just the most disgusting fish smell you could ever smell.
Really?
But because it was weeks and months with totally crappy waves, nothing was stopping us from going out there. We jumped in, and it was funny because I remember my teammate Casilda, we literally were side by side at the water's edge, and we jumped into this whitewash, and he sort of brushed up against me underwater, and I got a real like creepy feeling. Like I don't know if it was a like premonition or anything, but it was just this really weird, like I remember just this, the hairs on my, just kind of this weird feeling.
It was your buddy that did that?
It was my buddy. He just bumped into me underwater as soon as we got in the water, like within 1 second of being in the ocean. Bumped in, brushed me, and I got this like eerie chill go through my body. And we kind of came up and we paddled out, and right off the bat, he caught a wave. My friend Kyle caught a wave, and a couple of my other teammates caught a wave. And I was sitting out the back with a guy that I'd never seen before, a surfer. And it was just us. And we were probably in about 30 feet of water. So a couple hundred yards off the beach. The surf spot was called Major's Bay. And it's a long sandy sort of stretch of sand, but it goes into this rock topography underwater. And there's kind of a sudden change underwater. And we kind of sit right on that change, and that's how the wave breaks. And this beautiful wave came to both of us, and everybody else is way inside. And I looked at him kind of like, who's going to go for it? And I remember just kind of wanting to paddle like instantly to kind of signal my dominance that this is my wave, sort of show that, I guess, you know, you don't want to share waves with other people. And I remember my fingertips brushing the surface, and right as it did, right as I kind of made a little splash to catch the wave, a large tiger shark came up vertically, grabbed onto my legs. I didn't see a fin from afar. There was no sign of any shark in the water, any danger, anything like that. It was just a total blindside attack.
So you had already caught the wave? You were up on your board?
No,
you were still paddling?
I had not even caught a wave yet. This was, my hair was probably still dry. I'd just gotten out, just sitting there and literally paddled for this wave. And all of a sudden I felt like crazy amount of pressure. Like both of you were sitting on my legs and maybe another three or four people, like that much pressure. Felt no pain whatsoever. And the shark was right up in my chest. It was very night as day or day as night, whatever, that I was getting attacked by a shark. There was no, like, what is happening? I saw the shark. I knew it was a tiger shark. It had the most squarest nose, like almost like a table that square. And it was just completely pressed to my chest. And I just felt the pressure clamping more and more down on my legs. And I took my right hand and I tried to get my legs out of its mouth. And I remember it sort of all of a sudden doing this sway back and forth. And I was just going left and right, swaying with the shark as it.
Wow. I didn't realize it had gotten into your chest like that. I thought it was.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess its nose, its jaws would have been on my legs, but its nose was probably pressed into my chest. And then after the swaying finished, I tried taking both my hands, and I remember pushing it away, like trying to get away from my body, I guess, on its nose, both hands on its nose. And it's still, it kind of did this like articulating kind of jaw movement. I remember like kind of getting a better grip. And then right there with my left hand, I just started stalking it as hard as I could on the nose. I think I gave like 2 to 3 good punches, and then it just released that pressure. And I just felt it completely release and disappear. I don't even remember it disappearing, but it must have just gone right back underwater. And I got back on my bodyboard, and the guy next to me, I looked at him. He was as white as a ghost. His eyes were literally like bugging out of his head. And I yelled, "Shark, go in." And he just didn't even say a word. He just took off.
Wow.
And he must have been like 3 to 4 feet away from me when I got attacked, like really close. And I kind of started doing the paddle behind him, and I looked at my right hand, my index finger, and I could see that I'd cut my hand, sticking my hand in the shark's mouth. And I saw a little bit of bone, and it was split open like a potato. And I was like, oh boy, I'm hurt. I better go in. And he just started beelining to the beach fast. And I took like 3 or 4 paddle strokes. And when you're paddling, you're in a prone position. You don't see what's behind you. And I felt my right leg started doing this crazy spasm, like an uncontrollable shake. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, okay, it's the shark. It's finishing me off. It's going to bite my legs again. And I turned my head to look behind me, thinking I was going to see just a huge set of jaws finishing me off. And it wasn't that. It was my legs severed off completely, like absolutely a perfect cut right off. And it was, I think that pulsing feeling was blood was like shooting free, like out of a horror movie. Like it must have been like, maybe exaggerating, but like 10 feet in the air, just huge squirts of blood.
Really?
Yeah. And just, it was like a fire hydrant of blood.
How did you not pass out instantly?
Yeah. I don't know. I was like worried about my finger with a cut on my finger. Yeah. And then this was like, oh boy. And then luckily a little tiny, like a probably knee high wave came right then. And I caught it and rode it right up to the sand. My teammates saw what was happening. They first, later they told me they thought I had a red rash guard around my leg, like a red wetsuit top. Mm. And then Kyle was like, wait a minute, he didn't have a red, what's, and then he's like, oh, that's blood. And then they all kind of came to my aid, and I rode it right up to the sand, and just, you're used to having two legs, I guess, your whole life. And I thought I could just stand up and without a leg to fall on, I just instantly, I remember catching it kind of up this sand berm and then standing up, but losing my balance and rolling back down the berm. And I was just completely covered in this blood sand combination. And Kyle ran up to me. He dragged me up a little higher on the beach, took my leash, made a tourniquet with it. And the plastic leash that holds me to my board, and did it right above my knee, kind of on the thigh area, which I later found saved my life. And he started saying a prayer for me, and I closed my eyes, and he was praying, and I kind of felt like this, I'm going to die, but it's going to be okay. And there was no fear, like my family, any of that stuff. It's just a real comfortable feeling. And then I opened my eyes, and there was a pickup truck right there, and they threw me in the back of the truck. And there was a couple surfboards back there, and they didn't really think to like jump in the back. Anybody, and the guy just took off. And I was just laying in the bed of the truck by myself. Wow. And he beelined it to the hospital. And, we went out one gate on the military base, and he had a cell phone. He called 911, and they sent an ambulance, and the ambulance actually came the other way. So we missed the ambulance. And then we got on the main road, and it was a pretty short drive to the hospital, but I started going into shock, getting really hot, really cold over and over. And there was a couple surfboards next to me that were made out of this, kind of a cloth, interwoven cloth bag. And I remember just not wanting to look at my injury. And so I'm like, okay, I'm just going to play with the board bag and I just sort of used my fingers and felt the cloth and kind of played with the cloth and was like, it was just crazy, really hot, really cold, trying to rip off my wetsuit top to trying to, and then I was like, okay. And I looked, not looking at my leg. I remember looking at cars as we were passing these cars. And you know how you can tell the extent of your injury by the look of other people's expressions? I remember passing this, and this would have been about 7:30 in the morning now. And there was like families going to school, and I looked, and it was a daughter and a mother. And as we passed them, they just saw every blood's going out of the tailgate, missing leg, like just the whole nine yards. And the look on their face, I was like, oh boy, this isn't good.
And you're still not feeling anything.
I'm still not feeling any pain. I just, all I felt was just incredible hot to cold, like over and over, hot, cold, hot, cold, hot, cold. And we pulled up to the emergency room, and just everybody started rushing out of the door of the ER. And I remember, I don't know if it was a nurse or a doctor, but somebody ran right up to me, and they put their arm on my shoulder. And as soon as they touched me, I just passed out. Mm. And I think maybe I was just like trying to hold on until help came or something. Mm-hmm. But it was literally, I just remember passing out. And then I woke up, and it was called KVMH. It's a smaller hospital. And I woke up in the emergency room, and I was they'd cut off all my clothes, and I was just kind of laying there, and sort of all these people looking on top of me, and I was just like, you guys, I got attacked by, I remember telling him, I got attacked by a shark, and I'm positive it was a tiger shark, and there was a light fixture on the ceiling, this plastic fixture deal, and I was like, it was like this wide, the nose, and I remember telling him it has to be a tiger shark because it was like this square and things like that. And then I passed out again, and I woke up sort of in this lucid state in an ambulance. My dad's a paramedic, and it was one of his working partners that was driving us. And he was kind of just making some lighthearted shark jokes and things like that. And I kind of was did like this weird laugh and passed out again. And it would have been about almost 24 hours. I woke up again in our main hospital post-surgery with my parents' bedside. And there's a real somber moment, and the doctor looking at my mom, and the mom looking at my doctor, and the doctor saying, should you want to tell him? And my mom, you know, Mike, you got attacked by a shark and you lost your leg. And I was like, yeah, I know, I saw it come off. And and after I said that, everybody was kind of elated, and it was, you know, he's alive and he's okay with losing a limb. And I just felt really like I wasn't sad that I was an amputee. I was just happy that I was alive because I really thought I wasn't going to make it, and to have my family there. And maybe it was a combination of the morphine or something, but I was just, I didn't feel too much. I don't know.
Yeah, morphine's really a magical thing.
I just felt really happy. I was like content, and I was like, "We're gonna get through this." And
you must
had no idea about prosthetics. No idea about prosthetics or anything, and just I was like, "Okay, this is a new chapter."
So clearly,
I spent about a week in the hospital, and
a week.
And I was bedridden for about 3 weeks after, so it was about a month out of the water, and that was the hardest part for me.
That's
wasn't
still
actually
pretty
losing
amazing.
A limb. Was just being out of the water that long.
So Mike, you clearly have, you know, this I'm sitting here and amazing story and coming through it. And clearly you have gone back on the water. You're a photographer. So how does one come through something like that and make the decision to do that on any level? And what was going through your mind and your heart? And I mean, how do you get to that conclusion to go back?
I was young, and I had a really good family. Mm. I believe that I was, I didn't die for a reason, and that I was, right. I don't know, I just felt like I was living on borrowed time.
Mm.
And I had such strong support from the community. And basically, as traumatic and life-changing as it sounds, 1 month later, when the doctor said the stitches and staples can get removed and the risk of infection was gone, I was right back in the water. And my life kind of just didn't miss a beat. And I was back doing what I love more than anything on earth with my friends, just in a different way. But mm-hmm. it wasn't really taken away from me. I just had to adapt. And mm-hmm. I think all those things combined just kind of helped me. Yeah. I mean, there's been other things in my life that to me were more traumatic and more significant and more, I don't know, just harder to deal with. And this wasn't really one of them in a weird way. And I've been asked this a bunch, and knowing that I would become an amputee and my leg would be gone if I'd paddle out that morning. And absolutely, it was the greatest day of my life in a way. Well, best thing that ever happened to me.
That's the way I look at a lot of, the bad things, or, what people see as bad things happening in your life. And it does open your eyes to new things. And, as bad as it, what you experienced, I think it has created a whole new life for you that is even better. If that makes sense.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm not wanting like sugarcoat it, that it was like this amazing, like incredible moment. Like, but I'm sure it was hard on my family. I had a lot of times where prosthetics were breaking and crummy prosthetics. And for a while I had the worst limp and I could get blisters that you wouldn't believe. And it was some trying times, but all in all, I guess it made me who I am now, and my life is pretty dang good.
When did the photography come into play?
So what it was I had a bunch of donations from people that kind of just the community came out, and I had a little slush fund. So I didn't really have to, I was 18 and now kind of my whole dreams of being a professional bodyboarder were thrown out the window. And I basically eventually had to get a job maybe 6 months after the attack and find a way to sort of make some money. And I had a friend who owned a surf shop, and she's like, you can come work at the surf shop if you want. I was like, okay, I love surfing, and this will be easy. And da, da, da. And I first day on the job, I had a stand on my crummy prosthetic at the time. I'm very fortunate now. I have the best prosthetics in the world. But when I first started, I was basically, it felt like I was on a wooden peg leg that did not fit well and just was so painful. And that first day at the surf shop, I just stood there all day. And that evening I went to sleep, and by the middle of the night, I woke up and I had the gnarliest blister I ever could imagine. Like, my knee was so infected. I had to go to the emergency room and get cut open and go on antibiotics and all this. And I'm just thinking, every job on this island is tourism based. You've got to stand around, you've got to do this and that. And do a lot of walk valet. One of my friends were valet guys, and you got to run. I don't know if I can do this. Mm-hmm. And I had a long talk with my mom and my coach on my bodyboarding team. He had a lot of camera gear, and I would just enjoy taking photos. And during that month I was out, I did a little bit of photography with my friends, and because they're some of the top bodyboarders and top surfers in the world, magazines, like I would send, it was the day of slides, and I would send slides to the magazines, and it kind of rolled on for a few months after the attack. And I really fell in love with it and started using some of the money that the magazines or some of these guys' sponsors would pay. And I bought my own camera. I remember it was a Canon, I forget, it was a film camera. We shot mostly Velvia, and I just loved it. And I talked to my mom after that day at the surf shop, and she's like, well, if you want to, we'll help pay a little bit if you want to go to art school and study photography. And I applied for Brooks Institute of Photography and got accepted.
Oh, and that's a great one.
Basically, as soon as I got that acceptance letter, I packed up and moved to Santa Barbara and spent 4 years studying photography and studying art in Santa Barbara. And just the more I just absolutely love photography. And I suck at drawing. I suck at music. I suck at all these other creative outlets. But for me, like when I look
thank God for photography, finder, right?
You and I have a lot in common.
the photographer's secret, right?
Yeah. But it just makes sense. Looking in the viewfinder and just everything, just to me, like everything just made sense when I looked through the camera. And I love sharing that stoke with other people and sharing moments. And there was just, there seemed to be a bit of magic prior to digital about film and about and printing your own stuff or getting your slides back from the lab. Or there was just, I don't know.
Yeah, for me, it's funny to hear you say that because I don't – there's, I mean, I guess there's a little difference because you know, you can actually surf, but I love surf photography, and I guess it's because I suck so bad at surfing. Yeah, it's like, I can't do it. And it's the same thing with my music. I am not musically inclined for anything. I know three chords on my ukulele and that's about it, but
there are only three chords on a ukulele.
But I love music. So I just, that's why I've been photographing it for so long. It's my contribution and my way to get into that part of the world. And
so
is that how the two of you met, through photography, Rodney? Or
no.
Let's talk about that.
We were both on a trip shooting photos.
Yeah. A buddy of mine called me and he was running a trip to Tiger Beach. And they had one spot left, and he said, you know, and I didn't know of Mike then, but he said, you know, Mike's going to be on this trip, and told me about him. So I looked him up, and I was like, yeah, I want to meet this guy. So I went, and yeah, we became buds, and I said, yeah, it's been a, you know, interesting story, and I've loved following what he's doing. And you know, you're and until we got quarantined, you were on quite a bit of shark trips. You go out to Guadalupe quite a bit. I'm surprised we haven't crossed paths on that one.
It almost seems like an eternity ago, that trip to Tiger Beach, and I got PADI certified when I was really young, and there was a long time where I didn't do any scuba diving, and that was kind of my first like dive trip. And I remember the first day, the boat captain, he's like, where's your dive gear? And I'm like, dive gear? Do I need to bring dive gear?
I remember that.
I didn't have a regulator. I had nothing. I didn't bring anything. I think I just brought a mask or something. And I was like, I like my own mask so it doesn't fog. And that's all. I thought it was like all inclusive, and I had no clue at all. But yeah, that does feel like a lifetime ago. But that was a really, really special trip. And to be honest, that was probably the best images I've ever taken on any trip. I still go through those images. We just got day in and day out of incredible clarity and a lot of sharks. Yeah. And I think maybe just as well, like my photography style is, I just didn't know what I was doing really underwater as much. And I just, I don't know, I was more, a little more creative. And
well, your underwater style, are you, because that's what I do with, I take my portrait work that I do with musicians and I translate that to my underwater stuff, which gives me kind of my unique look. And you've got a very distinct look. So are you doing the same thing, you know, above and below, or do you have two totally different?
Great question. So when I went to Brooks, I studied portraiture. I wanted to be a swimsuit photographer. I wanted to work for Roxy and shoot girls in bikinis. And well,
who doesn't want to do that?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So
I'm not saying.
I was like, okay. I really learned how to shoot. I just wanted to shoot people and what lenses you use, techniques. And I studied a lot of portrait photographers and just day in and day out, just shooting people. That's all I shot, was people. I think I had done a little bit of underwater stuff at home, like shooting turtles and things. And I used a lot with the 15mm fisheye, but there's just, I don't know. I think it was that trip that I realized, like I was looking at some of the images when the very first day I shot with the 15. And then I think I took the 50mm down, the 51-2. And I was like, wow, this looks different. And it just, something gravitated me to that look. And that's more of what you'd shoot people with, like more of a portraiture lens. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's on the wide angle, maybe it's more environmental port, but it's still a person, you know, people lens. And I kind of just gravitated, I guess, to that look that I was capturing in it. And to, like, it's funny because you can listen to like underwater podcasts about underwater photography, shark photography, and everybody's doing something different. Everybody's like, you got to do this or that. And I really think it's just do what you love and do what you gravitate, you know. And
that's good advice.
And I guess the majority of stuff underwater shot with a wide angle, like a 15 or a fisheye. And I think a lot of that has to do with maybe some of these other dive sites around the world. They're not as clear as Guadalupe, as Tiger Beach. So you need to be closer to your subject underwater. Mm-hmm. And if you're shooting bigger subjects, you want to get it all in the frame. So you've got to use something wider. And it's basically the less volume you have between you and the subject underwater, the clearer the image. So you want to get as close as you can to that, whatever it is. And
yeah, there's nothing better than being inches away from a shark with a fisheye lens.
You know, I was just thinking that, Rodney. Yes. Yeah. Mike, where can people go to look at these fabulous photographs?
I'd say I'm most active on social media, on my Instagram. It's my name, Mike Coots. I do have a website that I do a bit of fine art printing. I have a large format Epson printer that I do prints here at home. I did four yesterday, but I really enjoy printing. I print on a nice kind of a mat. It's called Hot Press Bright. And I love the paper, and it's just got this like nice tone to it. But yeah, I have a website, and I have a website just for my general photography. I'm not just underwater stuff. I do a lot of commercial work, and my commercial work's at MikeCoots.com, and you can see some of my regular portraiture photography and some landscape stuff at Kauai. I do a bit of aerial work as well from helicopters, and that's a lot of surfing stuff as well.
So you've got the real big drones.
Yeah. I have some drones, but there's nothing like shooting from a helicopter. Yeah. And especially big waves, I like using longer focal lengths. I just like using longer focal, any type of photography. Mm. Yeah.
Well, we've got to tell everybody too that you probably have the most famous shark photo that just about everybody has seen. And Chick has probably seen it and doesn't even realize it.
And that would be what?
I got lucky. I'll give you a little backstory. I was dating a girl at the time, and I had a friend that was getting married in New Zealand. One of my close friends from when I lived there, and we were going to the wedding, and I wanted to surprise her for I think it was a Christmas present to do some shark diving. And I just Googled shark diving in New Zealand, and sure enough, there was a great white dive off the South Island, a place called Stewart Island, the very bottom of the South Island. And I had this old GoPro. I think it was a Hero 2.
See, I thought you got this photo in Guadalupe. So.
Yeah, no, this is in New Zealand. And what I did was I had been doing a little bit of like surfing selfie stuff. So I knew how to use and I would just not even use a selfie stick really. It'd be like a wooden dowel. And I put the GoPro bicycle mount on the end, and I would put on the half second timer mode and just put it in my mouth, catch a wave, stand up and hold it and shoot like that. And I was like, well, why don't I just do that and get a longer dowel and stick it underwater and see how it goes. And we flew to New Zealand, went to the South Island, and day before the dive, went to the hardware store and just got, I think it was like a 6 foot long wooden dowel. Next day we woke up real early and got on the boat, and it's this captain, a great guy, Mike Haynes, but he's just the most like old school captain. Just New Zealand is rugged, and you can tell this guy's seen it all, been there, done, you know, everything under the sun. And he just looks at me like, who is this American coming on my boat with this 6-8 foot long wooden piece of or wooden doll, you know, like just, you know, how you kind of eye people when they come on your boat and like, what is this guy bringing on here? And, but he's like, all right, whatever. And we had finished doing our underwater diving that day. And I just hooked up the camera to the pole and just kind of hung it off the side of the boat and put on the half second timer mode, not really thinking anything of it, and sat there for about a minute. And sure enough, a great white sort of just emerged vertically and opened its mouth. And I was like, whoa, I've never, you know, I had been to Guadalupe a couple times prior to that trip, and I'd never seen that at Guadalupe. And I was like, oh, that was kind of interesting. And got home at that evening and looked at it on my laptop and was like, oh, this is kind of an interesting photo. And I went to my friend's wedding, and he had proper Wi-Fi there. And I sent it to a new Instagram account that I just started following called Discover Sharks. And I had never really sent a message to anybody like, here's a photo that I took. It was always just reposts kind of deal. And I sent it to him, and I'm like, what do you like of this image if you want to share it? And he shared it, and it kind of, people like enjoyed it. And it turned into a meme, and it's when a shark steps on a Lego image, and that's the meme. And there's a meme, I guess, Instagram account called 9gag that I think they have like tens of millions of followers, and they saw that and they create a meme with it, and it just took off, and it just kind of grew on its own.
Chick's kind of looking at me, the photo, the shark is coming out of the water vertical, and his mouth is wide open. And you know, like when you step on a Lego, you go.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's what.
It's been, oh my God, something touched me or touched my private parts. It's been, there's been sort of some, marked in a couple different memes. Yeah.
Oh, that's
great. And if I got a penny for, I think every time that was, I would,
you'd have a lot of pennies, a lot of pennies.
You'd do a lot more shark diving.
Well, Mike, with all these stories, when I was reading some of them about you before today, one of the thoughts that crossed my mind was, of all of these things, you would seem to be one of the most unlikely people on the planet to have become a prominent conservation advocate for sharks. So why do sharks need an advocate? Aren't they the apex predator? Don't they rule the ocean? I mean, what is that all about, and what exactly do you do as a conservation advocate?
And that's a great question as well. And this is something I really didn't know about after the shark attack. I was really curious, like, why I got attacked, what that smell was, that fishy smell. And I would go to the library, and I'd read a lot of books or the books that they had here on shark attacks. And ask a lot of, like, I had friends that got attacked and people that were out when people got attacked. And I just was trying to find, I guess, answers of why I got attacked. And I really knew a lot about what sharks were doing to people, but I had no idea what we were doing to sharks. Mm. And it was the year after I finished up college, I got a phone call from this lady, Debbie. She lived in Florida. And she's like, "Hey, Mike, you don't know me. My name is Debbie, but I actually got attacked by a shark as well. And we're kind of pulling together a couple of people from around the world that might be interested in shark conservation." And that was a word I never had heard in any of these shark attack books. I never even knew what shark, I didn't even know it was a thing. Right. I was just like, sharks have a lot of teeth. They bite people. They bit my leg off. And that's what a shark is. And she's like, don't worry. Just go to YouTube and watch. It's called Shark Water by Rob Stewart. And call me back tomorrow on this number after you watch the film and let me know what you think. So that evening I watched the film and I was like, wow, this is really interesting stuff. And it was about halfway through the film, they started talking about some numbers of what was going on. They kind of talked about shark finning and things, but then the statistic came on the screen and it was 70 million sharks a year killed for their fins. And I saw that number and that number to me,
those
really,
are the ones just
really,
for the fins.
Yeah. And I just was like, what the, I'm like, this has gotta be, this is wrong.
It's gotta be
there's a couple zeros off of here. Yeah.
Exactly.
Rewound it, and sure enough, and I just from there I just reached more and more, and I was like, this does not seem right. And I'd done a lot of fishing when I was a kid, and I knew that this, you know, that we need fish in our oceans, and and just everything's interconnected. And I just, the more I thought about it, I just felt really compelled, I guess, in my unique situation to do something.
Mm-hmm.
So I called her back, and she's like, "Well, we're getting together some people in Washington. If you want to just talk to Congress," basically, so some U.S. senators, there's a bill going through that's closing some loopholes on shark finning. And if you want to kind of speak your voice as a shark attack survivor, and what we'll do is we'll have a scientist with you, and you can learn some of the science. You'll be in Washington for a week or so and learn some of the science and come into these offices of Congress and talk to them and have the scientists talk to them. And we did that, and we were able to get that bill passed. And it was like, I was like, well, this is, you know, I had definitely a rose colored optics of policy making and our government. And shortly thereafter, we had a bill going through here in Hawaii that made Hawaii the first state in the U.S. to basically make shark fin contraband, like drugs. Mm. Not the sale of shark fin soup, but actually having a shark fin detached from a shark's body that was illegal, and the crime had a lot of teeth in it. So it was not something where it was just like a little slap on the wrist that you get in big trouble and pay these big fines, possible jail time and this and that. And I spoke out for that bill, and we got that bill passed. And then I got invited to New York to speak to the United Nations about creating marine protected areas and other countries piggybacking on these areas to create bigger swaths of protected.
Yeah, that was my question.
Basically protected waters, yeah.
How much of this has been catching on, and other countries are collaborating to make this a global effort?
Yep. So there's definitely a lot of forward-thinking countries in. And I'm not sure statistically what it is right now of what area of our seas are protected. I'm a firm believer in marine protected areas. I think it's sort of like you can't just have a checking account and just take, because eventually you're going to be broke. You need to have a savings account, and a savings account that has interest that you can maybe put back into that checking. And you sort of got this always revolving, I don't know, just this, I think that's what protected areas do, is it's a no take off limit area. And I was I was involved in the expansion of Papahanaumokuakea. It's our northwestern Hawaiian Islands. And it was the last year Obama was in office. And just some really brilliant minds here on our oceans thought it'd be a good idea to sort of pitch this as a farewell to his time in office. And because he's from Hawaii, it just made a really good fit. And the first George Bush had actually created the area. He, I believe the backstory is Jacques Cousteau's son came in and did a documentary out there, and Barbara and him watched it and they're blown away. And he basically signed right then and there, created this protected area that was off limit to commercial fisheries. And it was a good size area, but the expansion of it that happened during Obama's last term basically created the largest protected area on Earth, land or water.
And sure enough. Yeah. And it's amazing how fast these areas do recover when you let them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I created this petition and we got a bunch of signatures to give to the White House. And in the process, I started getting a lot of flack from the fishing community. I was getting death threats, and it was a bit of a hard time for me because I just kind of was happy-go-lucky guy, and to have people that basically said they wanted to kill me and started social media campaigns against me. Yeah. It was, for me, there's a lot of internal turmoil, and I was scared to kind of go to restaurants and other people were going to spit in my food and things. And I had to go and do these talks in front of my peers. And it was a really growing time for me. But, and a lot of the premise was that you're going to take away this huge fishing area, and now tuna prices in Hawaii and across the United States are going to skyrocket. It's going to collapse. It's going to basically going to collapse the tuna fishing industry, and people love eating raw poke, sashimi in Hawaii. It's a real cultural thing. So they sort of use that as sort of the premise that don't create this protected area because now there's going to be no tuna fisheries. And sure enough, the tuna fisheries are catching more tuna than they've ever caught because science just says you create these areas, you're going to have spillover and fish will have time to reproduce and get bigger and fatter. And you just, your checking account's getting depleted. So you got to have the savings account. And sure enough, science worked out. Yeah.
So are you getting respect for this now? Or are you still having people,
No, I think through time, just stuff heals, things heal and things like that. And hopefully it's just a learning lesson that, science-based marine policy, it's just, we need data, we need science, and we need things, because money and these commercial fisheries have so much of it, and they have so much power in politics, that at the end of the day, without science and without data, without biologists going out, let's say tagging sharks and creating these data sets, money's going to rule everything at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you need to have science and you need to have data to show that this is what's happening. We need to stop this, slow this down, create quotas for this, this and this. Otherwise, it's just going to be business as usual and our oceans are going to be depleted faster than we know it.
Could you ever have dreamed all those years ago that you would be in this position to be an activist and to make such a difference? There's another area I wanted to, as we're getting perilously close to our close here, but I'm also aware that you are an advocate and you also do work on behalf of other amputees and helping them get back in the ocean or the aquatic world. Can you tell us about that and how that started?
It probably started, I guess, that week I was in the hospital. And nothing against quadriplegic and paraplegics and those in chairs and wheelchairs, but I thought I was going to be in a wheelchair. I had no idea about prosthetics. And I was visited in the hospital by a guy, I think on the third day, he was wearing pants. And I didn't know who he was. And he just said, praying for you, well wishes, whatever. And he was there for 5 minutes left. And my mom was like, he's got a prosthetic. And I had never seen a prosthetic in my life. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of a moment like, okay, I'm going to have a device that's going to help me get around. And it was that visit from him, as insignificant as it was until I knew that he was like me. It really helped me out a lot. Mm-hmm. And after the attack, there had been other attacks on the island. And I just remember that visit and how important that was to me at the time. And me and Bethany Hamilton, she's a fellow shark attack survivor on Kauai, mm-hmm. we'd start visiting these shark attack victims. And we realized how much it helped them as well in that process. Just kind of same, and it's one thing a doctor tells you something, but it's somebody that's missing a limb come in and be like, it's going to be okay. Or it's going to be trying, but this is what you can do to help and this and this and this. And we just kind of just, just a way to give back. And we've been doing it since then. And I've been fortunate to partner with charities and nonprofits that do similar work or that help help people in wheelchairs that want to do sports, or amputee surfers that want to learn how to surf, kids that are missing limbs. And just, we do surf camps, we do outreach programs. There's a lot of fun things that we do. And I know that, you know, if these kids come to the surf camp and they're there for 3 days, maybe it's the 3 days out of the year, that they're not different than anybody else, that they're all in this together. And, the kids really seem to enjoy it. And it's funny, because a lot of times the parents will come as well, and you can see the parents, like, I don't know, to them, they're in tears, and it's something, it's pretty special.
Yeah. I think the last time I talked to you, you were flying over to California for, I don't know, it was a competition. You were judging a competition, or were you in it, or?
Yeah, I do both. We do like these kids surf camps, and the last day we'll have a surfing competition, and we'll do prizes, or it's really fun. And then there's also some pretty big surfing events for the adaptive community. There's the ISA World Surfing Adaptive Championships, which brings amputees and blind surfers, deaf surfers, paraplegics, a lot of spinal cord injuries from around the world, and they all get together and compete in different divisions, and it's really fun. And you can see kind of what other people's using, I guess, you know, in my division with their prosthetics, and and even watch like blind surfers surf is the most incredible thing you've ever seen. Like, imagine that, being in the ocean and trying to catch a wave completely blind. It's just absolutely incredible.
Is that a teamwork thing, or is that strictly a feel?
Nope. It's a teamwork thing. So you'll have a guy that will kind of give you like verbal cues, you know, get up, a wave's coming, duck, dive. But it's still just watch these guys, because once you're on the wave, you're just in your own zone. So
you're not doing this in Pipeline.
No, but actually a guy has.
Really?
Believe it or not, yes.
Yeah, Pipeline's huge.
Yeah. No, it's been done, and it's incredible. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's crazy.
Well, with all the ways that you are enjoying and impacting the ocean world and the world of sharks and the photography, all these challenges that you're very much on the forefront of, what's the next step? What's your next hope for what can happen with sharks and the ocean worlds?
I mean, the ultimate goal for everybody that loves the ocean and for love sharks is just to have a healthy, abundant ecosystem underwater. And it's hard sometimes. You turn on the computer and it's all doom and gloom, whether it's ocean acidification, global warming, coral bleaching, just microplastics. There's so many issues, and it feels like our oceans are in such, it's definitely a defining point right now. And I guess just the ultimate goal was, or for me, I mean, it's fun to shoot photos underwater. It's fun to, you know, and it feels rewarding to get policy created and all this. But my ultimate hope, I guess, is just to inspire somebody with my image making that is going to one day help save our oceans. And the ocean has given me so much. I feel like I haven't even repaid that. It hasn't been reciprocal to even 0.100001% for what it's given me. And my hope is just to, my images will just spark that young mind that will have some profound impact on the future health of our seas. That's the goal.
Well, I can tell you for sure you've inspired two people sitting here in Wimberley, Texas on this hot day. We're just so grateful to have this conversation with you about everything we want this podcast to be. About the power of place.
And thanks for giving me this opportunity just to talk about these things. Yeah.
Well, I hope you'll come back at another time, because I have a feeling you're going to have more new things that you're involved with pretty soon. So we hope you'll share them with us first. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, guys.
It's just been great talking to you.
Thanks so much. Yeah, Mike, you know, as soon as all this stuff's over, we need to get on a trip together again, whether it's Tiger Beach or Guadalupe or wherever it is. But
I'm ready for the water again.
I think a Tiger Beach reunion would be perfect, and I'll bring my dive gear this time.
Yeah. Why? It worked without it last time.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you again, Mike Coots, and I also want to thank our listeners for joining us for another episode of Passports, Please. And we would be remiss if we did not thank Glenn Brock Thomas, our excellent producer, and Rupert Neve Design for our fabulous studio equipment, and Donovan Frankenreiter, who has graciously provided us with our intro and our outro music. So until next time, remember that great adventures of the heart, the mind, and the body, and the spirit begin when you hear the words, Passports, Please.